This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, a new book maintains that the real Russiagate conspirators are the CIA and the Deep State, which concocted the allegations in order to destroy any chance of peace with Moscow. Activists fighting for community control of the Chicago police have targeted virtually the entire city council for ouster in the next elections. And the American Public Health Association endorses treating police violence as a national public health issue.
But first, the Southern Human Rights Organizers Conference gathered its forces for a conference in Atlanta, Georgia, this past weekend. Black Agenda Report was there.
Bruce Dixon here, Saturday, December 8th, at the Southern Human Rights Organizers Conference in Atlanta, talking to Afia Nwangaza about Mark Lamont Hill, the Temple University professor who was just fired from CNN, and now Temple's coming after him too. What should we be doing to protect ourselves and retain the ability to talk about these things?
Have our own institutions. How many times do we have to go through this before we get the message? Develop our own media. He who pays the piper calls the tune. And I don't even understand why Mark Lamont Hill didn't expect the blowback he's getting.
All right, Afia Nwangaza from the Southern Human Rights Organizers Conference here in Atlanta. And we're talking to Rose Brewer here from the Black Alliance for Peace. First, why are you here? What's going on here with the Southern Human Rights Organizers Conference?
Well, you know, there's a deep history to this conference, and it's always been about liberation and struggle, and at this point in time, I feel it's a space I should be in. If you're talking about liberation, struggle, and Black freedom, this is where I should be.
What's the connection between the Black Alliance for Peace and the Southern Human Rights Organizers Conference?
There's a deep connection. As you may know, there are a couple of campaigns we're involved in, one of them being looking at AFRICOM, the location of U.S. military bases in Africa, and that certainly is connected to the issues we're facing in this country with the occupation of Black communities, the training of police by Israel. So human rights, that question is at the heart of the work that we're doing with BAP. And those two campaigns over there and here are deeply connected to many of the issues that are being raised here.
I live almost exactly 25 miles north of here. We got a brand new congresswoman, a Black woman, named Lucy McBath, who a horrible thing happened to her a few years ago. She's the mother of that kid in Georgia who got shot for playing his music too loud.
Right.
Lucy McBath, 6 weeks before the election, she showed up in a masjid fishing for votes. And somebody we know asked her, well, what about the 800 military bases that the U.S. has around the world? She says, I don't know anything about that. I'll have to study that up. So how should we approach Black politicians like Lucy McBath who say they don't know nothing about this stuff?
Well, you know, that's some serious business. One of the things that is very apparent is that there is broad-scale either ignorance or willful unknowingness about the role of U.S. empire globally. That's not what Black politicians are focused on. We shouldn't be amazed, we shouldn't be surprised, but that doesn't get them off the hook. We've got to put this on the agenda. That's another piece of this campaign. We're going to try to hold the CBC responsible. What is your position on bases in Africa? What is your position on AFRICOM? So we'll see. It's a way to separate the wheat from the chaff. We're going to see who stands strong and who doesn't. I'm sorry that the new representative is uninformed, but a third piece of our work is to engage in some deep-level political education to hold folk who supposedly represent the people accountable. And if they don't know, they better find out.
Finally, wonder if you could say a word about the can of worms that Mark Lamont Hill opened up when he spoke a few truths in front of the UN about Palestine and Israel and apartheid. And, you know, Temple University is gun informed now, too. And there are laws on the books in some states that penalize economically companies and individuals associated with BDS, and perhaps we're on the verge of criminalizing it too. So what should we do to protect our right to be able to speak the truth to each other?
Well, I mean, we better take this very seriously, because it's a step in the direction of there's no resistance to anything that Israel says or does. And the Academy is a space where free thought, free expression is supposedly, I'm putting that in quotation marks, but he wasn't speaking for Temple University. He was speaking in a UN forum, and he had a right to put those issues on the agenda. This has been one of the really disturbing aspects of where we are in 21st century U.S., the absolute erasure of any kind of critique of this country and our relationship to it. So I think it's a demand on our part to make it very clear that we won't stand for this, that we can speak out against it, that Temple is expressing its money bags, because the threat there is we're going to withdraw money if this person is retained. So we better get clear about what we're up against and how we're going to deal with it.
Okay, Bruce Dixon here at the Southern Human Rights Organizers Conference. I'm talking to
Elandria Williams.
Of?
I represent myself today.
Okay, well, tell us, Elandria Williams, about Mark Lamont Hill being fired from CNN, and now Temple University is looking for a way to fire him.
Well, I think it's multiple pronged. I think, one, a lot of black folks actually need to understand what's happening between Palestine and Israel. When I went to Palestine with the African descent delegation a couple years ago, it was important for us to work with black churches and black leaders to understand exactly what the situation is. Because I think if you're still on the mindset that Israel is a savior place, and if you still believe in white Jesus, then it means you won't actually move. And so I think one thing we need to do is educate ourselves about what's happening in Palestine, understand what it means to be an apartheid state connected to Jim Crow, and what that means for us as black folks. I think it's important for us to understand what's happening to black people in Palestine as well, to see what boat they're in. And it's important for us to go, okay, what does it mean to have free speech? And what does it mean to stay and be able to stand up for what you believe in? And Mark Lamont has always been an organizer. He's always been close. I know him pretty well. And so I think what it also means for us to actually be ready to fight and for us to be able to organize in our own places. I know I live in Tennessee. And so there are a lot of things that are shifting where I live at every moment. But I think how you stand and how we used to sit in the state legislature and not let anything pass. And the things that need to happen on a federal and local level. But in the end of the day, we have to destroy some of the mythology around Christianity and destroy some of the mythology that keeps our folks tied into it is okay, and we're not supposed to say anything bad about the state of Israel.
All right, Elandria Williams here at the Southern Human Rights Organizers Conference on Saturday, December the 8th.
That was Black Agenda Report Managing Editor Bruce Dixon speaking from Atlanta.
The Mueller investigation into the so-called Russiagate scandal is reported to be nearing a conclusion, but after 2 years, there's still no hard evidence of collusion between WikiLeaks, the Russian government, and the Trump election campaign. Dan Kovalik is a longtime activist and author whose new book is titled The Plot to Scapegoat Russia, How the CIA and the Deep State Have Conspired to Vilify Putin. Kovalik says the spinners of the Russiagate tale are ginning up war fever, trying to destroy any chance that a peace movement will reemerge in the United States.
That project has worked quite well and effectively, as it did at times during the first Cold War between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. It's working in the very same way now, one, instilling fear in people in the United States of Russia as somehow an enemy, first of all, an enemy of the U.S., but also a seemingly omnipotent enemy that could even swing a U.S. election somehow. And so And what has worked incredibly about it is that it has really worked mostly on liberals in the U.S. who may otherwise be interested in organizing around war and peace. And it has really silenced the peace movement And also the other thing it has done is vilified people who, one, question the Russiagate claims, and also who try to claim that Russia is not an enemy. They are then seen as somehow stooges of Putin. And so, again, it has all of this reminiscence of the McCarthy period, and it's been working in the same way. Although, again, the irony is that it was the liberal left folks who were more resistant of McCarthyism the first go-round. Now they're the ones who are really leading the McCarthyist charge.
Yes, the insidious wrinkle with Russiagate is that folks who challenge those charges are associated with Trump.
Yes, absolutely. Right, you're seen as a Trump apologist, whether Russia somehow impacted the 2016 elections. And again, very few people want to be called a Trump apologist for good reasons. I mean, Trump is awful in many ways. But the thing is, there's a lot to criticize him about. Russia happens not to be one of them. I mean, it's one of the good things that he at least appeared to want to do, and that is have some sort of rapprochement with Russia. And this Russiagate scandal has effectively destroyed any ability to have detente with Russia. And now we're seeing a possible, really, military confrontation with Russia, with a U.S. naval ship now entering the Black Sea as we speak.
Russiagate is interesting from the standpoint of American exceptionalism, which says, among many other things, that there are terrible people out there in the world who just hate America because of our freedoms and what we have. And Putin is classified as one of those people, and they just want to stir up dissension in the United States.
Right. And of course, the irony is that to the extent people have issues with the United States outside the U.S., it's not because of our freedoms, but it's because the U.S. has done such an effective job at repressing freedom and democracy throughout the world. Quite contrary to, of course, what the U.S. claims. The U.S. has claimed very effectively for over a century that we intervene in the world to spread democracy and freedom and justice. But in fact, we do quite the opposite. And those who have suffered U.S. intervention are quite painfully aware of that. Meanwhile, of course, at home, we have a society that's very unequal, that has suffered from slavery, from systematic racism, from genocidal attacks on indigenous populations here. We don't need Russia to remind us of those things. Again, most people in this country who are paying attention, at least, are painfully aware of those problems. And the idea that somehow Russia was needed to stir those up is a joke, you know. But now, again, it's this thing where Russia is somehow omnipotent, that somehow, and this, what I rattle off is what people actually claim, that somehow Russia was behind the kneeling, NFL kneeling controversy, that somehow they were behind the Charlottesville conflict, that they are somehow stirring up racial tensions in this country and stirring up issues around police brutality. Again, this is absurd, absolutely absurd. And yet there are people who truly believe it, and people who I like and respect who believe.
Yes, it looks like they're painting the Kremlin as some kind of foreign outside agitator in the American sense of that word.
Yes, and again, that is very reminiscent of the traditional McCarthyist view in the old Cold War, where everyone who did anything, frankly, that was good was therefore labeled as a communist or under communist influence. You know, a classic example of that would be Martin Luther King, who many accused of somehow being a communist or a communist sympathizer. But essentially anyone who struggled for civil rights or peace was tarred with that label at one time or another. In fact, you know, there's a song, "You Ain't Done Nothing If Ain't Been Called Red," you know, and that's very true. And now we see that today, even though Russia, of course, is not red anymore in the sense of socialist, it still now continues to have this means of tarnishing people who are trying to otherwise do progressive things in this country.
In the white South, the outside agitator was the outsider who came in and stirred up troubles with the Negras that previously, supposedly, had not existed before.
Right, exactly. And again, you see that today, where Russia is somehow being accused of stirring up the African-American population, again, into kneeling at NFL football games and into opposing police brutality and to wanting Confederate symbols to be taken down. But somehow it's the Russians that inspired African-Americans and others to do that, which is completely absurd. And what it does, too, not only does it vilify people who are doing progressive things, but it takes away agency from people, particularly from African Americans. It's suggesting that on their own, they wouldn't do these things or couldn't do these things. They need Russian inspiration, if not Russian help, to do that. And again, that in and of itself is frankly racist.
You write, "I believe that Americans are the most uninformed, misinformed, and ideologized people on the planet." That's a lot of superlatives.
Yes, and I think it's true, though. I mean, I think you have a country, the United States, where most people from cradle to grave are taught and therefore believe that the U.S. is this beacon of freedom in the world, and we hold ourselves out as such. Meanwhile, the U.S. has undermined democracy and freedom throughout the world in a number of continents, particularly Latin America has been hard hit by U.S. intervention, where the U.S. has time and again overthrown democratically elected leaders and installed right-wing dictatorships, if not fascist dictatorships. It has done similar things in Africa, Asia, and even Europe. Greece stands out as a particular example of that. And yet, while we do those things, we still claim that we are a great influence in pursuit of democracy in the world. That people could believe that, given what the U.S. is doing, is quite incredible. And that is why I say what I say, that they are the most ideologized people on the planet. And I think for those of us who want to build a peace movement and who want to challenge U.S. empire, we need to break through that ideology. And that ideology is, as you noted, American exceptionalism. We have to destroy that. And that's why I write the things I do, the books I do, the articles I do. And that is why you do what you do, because we know that it is that ideology that really is destroying this country and the planet. We're the only empire in the world that's ever existed in history that has refused to call the largest empire that's ever existed. That is a feat. That is a feat of ideology. And we need to confront that.
Yes, some religious people used to say that the devil's greatest accomplishment is convincing people that he does not exist.
That is right. And in the case of the U.S., its greatest feat has been to convince its own people that we are a republic and not an empire. Now, no one else is fooled outside the U.S. Well, I shouldn't say that. I mean, I think for years, some people were fooled outside the U.S., though I think it's getting harder and harder for people outside the U.S. to deny the nature of the United States as an empire. You know, to use one pop culture reference, if I may, in the 70s when Star Wars came out, a lot of people immediately saw that the empire was a symbol of the United States and that people like the Vietnamese who were fighting that empire. But very few people see that now. Most people somehow see that the U.S. incredibly would represent some sort of rebel alliance or whatnot. But we are the empire. And the quicker we come to that realization, the quicker we can at least start dealing with that problem.
But it's amazing how the empire has a kind of bubble over it, insulating its own citizens from the existence and the crimes of empire. Americans not only can't find most countries in the world on the map, they can't even name the countries where the U.S. has killed hundreds of thousands of people.
Right. Well, yeah, and that's absolutely true. I mean, we have military bases in most countries of the world, but few know that. As you say, people have limited knowledge of geography. I remember one poll during the height of the Contra War with Nicaragua, 59% of Americans polled believed Nicaragua was in the Middle East. That is how ignorant people are, but they are actually encouraged to have that ignorance. It's part of the American hubris that we don't have to know where anything else is because the world begins and ends with us. There's this song I heard happen here on the radio the other day. A guy was playing country music, and there was a song about 9/11, and in the refrain, the singer says, "I don't know the difference between Iraq and Iran." Well, I wouldn't brag about that fact, but the point is very few people know the difference, and if you don't know that difference, there's no way you can intelligently confront the questions that American intervention raises.
For many people, Bernie Sanders is the great hope of getting rid of Trump and putting the country on a more progressive footing. But Bernie Sanders doesn't have much to say about foreign policy.
Yeah, very few of the so-called insurgents of the Democratic Party, including Bernie Sanders, are willing or able to discuss and critique U.S. foreign policy. And again, it's not an issue that voters seem to care much about, and so they don't feel a need to. I mean, the one congressperson that I actually like who is willing to speak very pointed truths about U.S. foreign policy is Tulsi Gabbard out of Hawaii. It actually gives me more hope than Bernie Sanders on those types of issues.
You know, I think that a guy like Bernie Sanders, with his history, might think that coming out with positions on foreign policy might allow him to be labeled as soft in the international sphere, as Democrats were often labeled by Republicans. But I thought it was also amazing that Donald Trump was able to talk about something sounding a little bit like peaceful coexistence with Russia in front of his right-wing audience, and they didn't blink an eye.
No, it is very interesting. And again, that is the one thing that I think the ruling elite could not stand about Trump. And that was that he was saying some very important truths, which again, seemed to be relatable to people. Not only that he wanted to make peace with Russia, but he also, during his campaign, was critical of countries like Saudi Arabia for supporting Al-Qaeda and ISIS. Those are things that are very taboo to say, even though they're absolutely true. And of course, since he's been elected and since the Russiagate investigation has taken hold and become a daily news item, he's really backed off saying any of those things. And his conduct reflects that backing off. You know, he's now really doubled down on Saudi Arabia. And he's now seems poised for a confrontation with Russia, backing out of the intermediate range nuclear treaty from 1987, supporting massive troop presence on the borders of Russia, and now again sending a naval ship into Russian waters. So in that sense, Russiagate has done its job with the complicity of many liberals. The last thing I would want to say, and that I do talk about in my book, that I think is very relevant, while we're going through this very anti-immigrant phase in the United States, and very much focused in particular on Central American immigrants, I think what is oftentimes lost in the discussion is how the U.S. has acted in Central America to make these countries unlivable for people. That is, we begrudge these immigrants from seeking refuge in the U.S. without many people understanding how the U.S. has supported death squads in countries like Honduras, like Guatemala, like El Salvador, how the U.S. supported a coup in 2009 that brought a very repressive regime to power, and that the immigrant flow from those countries is a direct consequence of those interventions. And I think if people understood that, I think they would feel more compassion for the people who are fleeing the mess that the U.S. has created.
Yes, you can't understand MS-13 without having a knowledge of how the United States destroyed civil society in El Salvador in the 1980s.
That's right. And for those folks who are Catholic, and I was raised Catholic, Archbishop Oscar Romero was just canonized as a saint on October 14th. He was killed by U.S.-backed forces in 1980. Literally, the U.S. was behind murdering a Catholic saint. And again, unless people can get their heads around that, they will not understand the depths of U.S. misconduct around the world.
That was Dan Kovalik speaking from Denmark.
Activists in Chicago are building on their unprecedented recent victory with the murder conviction of the white cop that killed Laquan McDonald. Frank Chapman is a veteran community organizer with the National Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression. He reflects on the state of the movement since the rebellion in Ferguson, Missouri in 2014.
We have experienced frustration after frustration of police officers being brought up for indictment, not getting indicted, police getting indicted, as what happened in North Carolina, going to trial and getting acquitted. So in the last 8 years, the experience has been in our movement that police do not get indicted, tried, and convicted when they kill black people or other people of color. And so Chicago is unique in the sense that we got one. And this would not have happened in the absence of the movement. It would not have happened. Now, I don't know about the whole entire country. Angela Davis tells me it's true of the whole country, but I haven't researched that. But I know in the history of Chicago, this is the first time that a white police officer has been charged and convicted for murdering a black person. That has not happened while on duty. It's unique in those ways. But the uniqueness that I would like to really stress is that we built a movement in this city for community control of the police. And it's a powerful movement. And, you know, we owe it to the legacy of Fred Hamilton that we have such a powerful movement in this city like that, because he was the one who started this ball rolling back in the late 60s.
And how will this conviction have a direct impact in achieving the goals of community control of the police in Chicago?
It gives people hope. It lets people know that we can bring about a change in the power relationships between the system, the oppressors, and the oppressed if those of us who are oppressed get together, get united, and fight. We can make changes happen. In fact, we're the only ones that can make it happen, because those who are in power are not interested in making it happen, and they're not going to make it happen. So if the people aren't in motion, if the people aren't doing things about this, then nothing's going to get done. And what we did here in Chicago, we put the people in motion. And we needed a victory like this here to give some encouragement and some hope so we can keep this motion going on. Because we're not lying when we say that ain't no power like the power of the people, and the power of the people don't stop. But that's a challenge to us also. To make that happen, we have to keep organizing people, keep agitating, keep organizing, keep educating.
People in different places mean very different things when they say community control of the police, and very different things when they use the term community policing. What do you mean by community control of the police?
Well, what we mean is that we take power from the police to do the policing. And we put that power in the hands of the community. We have drawn up a piece of legislation called CPAC. It's a Civilian Police Accountability Council. And that empowers the people in our communities to hire and fire the police chief. It empowers them to negotiate with the police union whatever the budget is. It empowers them to write the rule book for the police. It empowers them to regulate the police use of deadly force. It empowers them to stop police from doing racial profiling. In other words, it enables the people to say how our communities are policed and who polices them.
And of course, the police fight that tooth and nail, but so do city administrations.
Absolutely. It's going to be a fight. They're fighting this tooth and nail. the FOP and all the rest. But still, in spite of this here, our movement has continued to grow. And the reason why our movement continues to grow in spite of them fighting us back is because they continue to commit crimes. They continue to murder people without provocation or justification. They continue to carry out these racist, genocidal policies of shooting black people on sight. And so this constantly enrages our communities because they are powerless to do anything about it. And so the message that we're bringing to them is that, no, we're not powerless. We have to organize for change. And this is in spite of whatever discouragements may come, we have to organize for change. We have no other alternative. We either organize for change or we continue to endure the same.
Chicago also has a reputation of an alderman system in which at any given period you really can't count on most of the black aldermen to go along with progressive policies.
You're absolutely correct. We have one of the most corrupt city councils in this nation, and the black aldermen are included. So the election is coming up next year, right? 2019. So what are we doing about that? As of right now, we have over a dozen candidates for city council who are running as CPAC candidates. They're running on the question of police accountability. They're running on the question of community control of the police. This is part of their platform. We believe that by January, we can have this number up to 70. There's 200 candidates that are running all total. We think we can get 70 of them to support CPAC.
So basically, you're using these elections to seize the whole city government in name of community control of the police.
Absolutely. Why shouldn't we? We can make the challenge, and so we're going to do it. Win, lose, or draw, the people are going to come out of this struggle better educated and better prepared for the battles ahead.
How's the morale in the movement? We know the conviction of that cop must have boosted it tremendously.
It did. The same day that they came down with the guilty verdict, we had thousands of young people in the streets. We tied up the Central Business District downtown. That was the way we celebrated. We didn't celebrate it by going and having a private party. We took it to the streets.
And how much credit do you take for Rahm Emanuel not seeking another term?
A lot of credit. Because, see, he should, by right, and of course we know this system doesn't operate by that, does it? He should be on trial for murder himself, or at least complicit in a murder, because he's the one who sat on those tapes. The video recording of Laquan McDonald's murder, he sat on those tapes for 400 days so that he could guarantee his re-election in the last election. Because if those tapes had been revealed, he knew he couldn't have won that election. Well, they got revealed. And one of our main demands after those tapes got revealed was that he resign. He resigned. So he held out to the ninth inning. He held out all the way till it come time for re-elections again. And then he threw the towel in. Yes, we're responsible for that.
Rahm Emanuel also closed record numbers of schools, mostly in the black communities, created the conditions in which record numbers of black teachers were ousted from the system. How much collaboration and how big a connection have you made between the policies of the police and the policies of public education in Chicago?
Every time we protest, every time we organize, we make those connections. In fact, the Chicago Teachers Union is one of our big supporters. They endorse our campaign for CPAC, and we endorse their campaign for community control of the Board of Education.
In many cities, black local lawmakers are part of the block of politicians that constantly call for more money for police. But defundment of the police is one of the demands of lots of people in Chicago.
That's why we need political realignment. We need to change that. And we're going to change that city council. Right now, we have one alderman in the city council who supports community control of the police. His name is Alderman Carlos Rosa. And even the Latino caucus, which he's a part of, does not support him. So we're going to put some people in there that will be supporting him in 2019. We have to change this.
In many activist circles, the watchword these days is abolition of the police, at least of the police and of policing as we currently know it.
Well, here's my response to abolitionists. You know, I'm a communist, so I believe in abolition of the state, ultimately. But that's not going to happen right now. but they're killing us right now. And so we can share the vision with them of abolition, but they need to share the struggle with us in fighting right now to shift the power relationships between the police and our communities by demanding community control of the police. That's a democratic demand, and we can't put it off until the future. We got to fight for it now.
In terms of combating the police here and now and surveilling the police just as they surveil us, cop watches have sprung up all across the country. And we remember that the Black Panther Party began as a kind of cop watch.
We're in favor of all of that. Some of it is throwing pebbles at the wall. Some of it is throwing cannons at the wall. But we're in favor of all of that. But what it ultimately comes down to is who has the power. Watching them without having the power to control them is just that. It's just watching. So we're not saying don't watch, but with the purpose of changing things. We want power. It's all about power.
I remember that in 1970, it was Chicago where the first very progressive black police organization was formed, and chapters soon spread across the country. And those black police back in that day mostly were concerned with police brutality.
Well, we reopened those discussions, but as you know, the Black Patrolmen's Association is no longer a reality in Chicago. The black police in Chicago, for the most part, don't have a separate organization contesting racist police policies. So they have joined up with it. We're talking to police and letting them know that they have this option. They're not doing anything with it. So we can't wait on that. If we get community control of the police, we can make that happen ourselves. In fact, you're talking about Renault Robertson them.
Of course.
They started that organization here in Chicago as a result of the murder of Fred Hampton. That's how it got started. So it was agitated into existence out of a demand for community control of the police. Yeah, it's only going to really happen when we get community control of the police. That's all I'm saying. I'm not saying that these other piecemeal reforms are not important. We will use them to chip away at the wall. But to tear the wall down, we need community control of the police.
Have you seen any of these aldermen presented with this kind of threat to their seats, scratching their heads and maybe changing their minds?
Well, those aldermen that you're talking about are not hardly going to scratch their heads and wonder, because they are so entrenched, they are so corrupted by the system, and so they don't believe it can be changed. They've been completely won over by the ruling class in this city. They don't believe it can be changed. They're getting $100,000 a year salaries, and all kind of slush funds are coming at them. Every election year, they get all kinds of political action committee money thrown into their wards. So they're riding so high on the tide of corruption that they can't even imagine change. So we're going to have to wake them up. And the only way we can wake them up is by defeating them.
Chicago's always talked about as such a big union town. What kind of cooperation have you gotten in this long fight with the police from the labor movement?
Well, we've gotten some, but not enough. Like I said earlier, the teachers' union has been very adamant in their support of us. In fact, the teachers' union told people who came to them for political support for these elections that if they're not supporting CPAC, forget it. They're only going to support people who support CPAC. So the teachers union, which is the most militant, most progressive union in the city, has been behind us very strongly. The United Electrical Workers Union, which is a left-led union, has been behind us. SEIU, Service Employees International Union, Local 73, has been behind us. And then there's a lot of others that are on the fence, including the Coalition of Black Trade Unions is behind us in words. I wish they would do more in terms of actually putting some pressure on the aldermen, but that's an uphill struggle right now. That's an uphill struggle. In spite of what Trump said during the Ferguson uprising about how the union should come out and be supportive of the Black Liberation Movement and so forth and so on, we haven't seen any evidence of that here in Chicago with the Chicago Federation of Labor. They haven't come out in support of us because the FOP is part of that federation. And of course, they're using their union card to paralyze the rest of the trade union movement to come out in support of us. And, you know, a lot of people just don't have the guts to stand up to them. My hat's off to the teachers union and to SEIU Local 73 and others who have decided to stand up to them. But right now, we're very marginal support in terms of the trade union movement.
And you spoke of that one Latino alderman who's on the right side of this issue. But overall, how do you assess the collaboration between the Latino and Black communities on the police issue?
I can just say it plainly. They've sold us out. That's why we need to change it. Everybody knows it. The Latin Caucus, the Black Caucus, they are working with the police against the community in the name of stop the violence, in the name of some kind of community policing. But where the community has no control, you just come down and sit down and the police tell you what to do.
So the whole term community policing is a fraud.
It is a fraud, a big fraud. And Black people know this. And Latinx people know this because they see it. They've been looking at it for years. They know how much of a voice they have in those so-called community policing meetings. All they have is a voice. They have no power. This is such a crucial issue. I wish more of our people would come to this understanding that so long as we allow police tyranny and terror to exist in our communities, for that period of time, we will not be able to effectively organize the Black liberation movement. All we're going to be doing is participating in nostalgia about how great it was yesterday. But what about now? And the reason why now we don't have the movement that we need to have to break the back of this system is because police tyranny and terror exist in our communities, creating death and mass incarceration. If we don't stop this here, it's going to choke us out.
That was Frank Chapman of the National Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression in Chicago.
Jade Rivera is an activist with Critical Resistance, a group of health professionals and anti-policing organizations that recently got the American Public Health Association to endorse the principle of treating police violence as a public health issue. Ms. Rivera is co-author of the groundbreaking report that convinced the association that fundamental changes need to be made in how policing is done in the United States.
Basically, what our research found was that law enforcement violence impacts marginalized communities at a higher rate. So we're looking at, most specifically, communities of color, that is Black, Latino, Indigenous, as well as LGBTQ, those experiencing houselessness, et cetera, as having impacts around policing harms and violence.
And what flows from that? You identify the problem, that is, that violence of police has impacts on these targeted communities. But what do you do about it? What are the policy recommendations?
Also, going back, some of the other problem I think we're seeing is that we're also looking at how to look at the impacts. It's not only, I think we see in media, for instance, real high profile cases where folks have been killed by police violence and or law enforcement violence, and that we can also see that there are physical harms as well as mental health and stress associated with these types of interactions. So we see community trauma as an impact as well. So expanding the scope of how we understand what the implications of being surveilled or targeted or interacting with police are. And so we go ahead and name a lot of specific solutions and what we think are important for society and for our health field and public health field most specifically to address. So we have a lot of the ideas that we have proposed are rooted in community organizing campaigns, including Movement for Black Lives Matter platform. We have campaigns such as formerly 1% for LA Youth, now 5% for LA Youth campaign by Youth Justice Coalition, looking at how do we look at real upstream, what we talk about in public health is upstream solutions for change. So we have, how do we look at where are our public resources going to support communities most impacted by police violence? So how do we begin to or continue to invest in thriving communities? How do we continue to invest in community health and other what we call social determinants of health, education, access to health care, et cetera? So some of the solutions include not only reinvestment in communities and disinvestment from policing, but also looking at how public health can look at supporting and data collection around harms associated with policing.
We know that police agencies, in addition to inflicting violence, collect a huge amount of information, and lots of people are scared about what is done with that information, the character of the information. But some of that information, in fact, can build the case for better mental health care in these communities and for better health care in general.
Yeah, I think that public health has a lot of infrastructure around collecting data related to morbidity and mortality rates. So we can look at epidemiologists and data collection from a public health perspective that is independent of police agencies. So we think that that's important. We also think that it's important for public health to look at decriminalizing certain behaviors that are associated with economic inequity. So how do we look at decriminalizing folks who are houseless? So for instance, a lot of people who are houseless, or also known as homeless, will have interactions with policing and get targeted and kind of be vulnerable to that type of targeting. How do we invest in housing for all as a society? That's a public health perspective when we're looking at, so that would be decriminalization. Other solutions include demilitarization. We've had, since the war on drugs, an increase in militarized paraphernalia and training for local police departments. How do we look at using resources that could go back into the community instead of into further militarizing our police departments?
By almost any measure, U.S. society is the most violent in the developed world. Those who defend the police say, well, that's why police are needed and let them do their job. But others say, well, no, the police are part of the problem of American violence.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I think that one of the things that important piece around what this policy proposal does is it looks at how do we unpack and our understanding and really question the role of policing, most particularly in marginalized communities, communities of color, working class communities, around where we've just given the role of police of dealing with these issues through policing, right? And so we have what are kind of issues around that are rooted in classism, rooted in racism. We have police dealing with those, and instead of public health can look at how do we build places where people can have access to economic equity and not be selling drugs on the street, let's say, that because of being a black market becomes highly violent, right? What's the role of other state-funded resources that can support communities to be healthy and thriving and economically viable?
Yes, Black Lives Matter chapters around the country have for several years now been advocating a defunding of the police. But this action by the American Public Health Association contains lots of recommendations on how funds that are diverted from the police can be put to good public health use.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that we can think about how we can resource programs or how we can resource programs that build community-based alternatives to public safety and really reframe how we understand public safety and putting it back in community control, as well as what are the public resources and putting those back in community control as well.
Yes, and such a large and influential organization as this could also have an effect on how the media portrays violence and communities and police.
I hope so. I mean, our hope is to have real material change in our communities, and that we do begin to close the gap around the harms associated with policing for marginalized communities, be that through how we frame and understand the issue, be that among how we, where as a society we're going to invest and put resources, public resources, you know, keeping public resources into supporting communities. And really, I think what you're speaking to about the media piece and having a real cultural shift in how we understand what the issue is.
Now, this didn't come about just because a few activist social workers came to the conference and said, you guys ought to do this. This has been some years in the making.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that, you know, when we look at the issue of law enforcement violence in communities of color and working class communities, this is a generational issue. This has historic ties to the Black Panther movement that was foundationally founded on issues around police brutality in the Black community. We have examples in San Francisco where the Latino Chicano lowrider community was organizing around police violence as well. So these are issues that community organizations and grassroots organizing have been working on for years. And so as public health, what happened for us is a few of us were in a master's program and we decided to study police violence as a public health issue and really research it. And through that, we came to find like-minded public health organizers, researchers, writers, community planners, et cetera, who believe that public health should be at its foundation and core anti-oppressive and anti-racist. And we came together to write this proposal and provide solutions that we thought were what we think very upstream and looking at, how would I say, reframing how we understand the issues, not just to be about common discourse around reforms, including body cameras, tasers, and community-oriented policing, but to dive deeper and look at a deeper systematic issue. And so we were very influenced by community organizing that was happening at that time. Here in San Francisco, we had a prominent case, Justice for Alex Nieto, a young Latino man who was shot and killed by SFPD. And there was a lot of organizing, grassroots community organizing around seeking justice for that. We also had in San Francisco, at the time that we began the research, an organization called Frisco Five, and they were five individuals who went on hunger strike in front of a local police station asking for the resignation of the police chief. So there was a lot of organizing happening in the community at the time of us beginning this research, and we wanted to put public health in line what was happening in communities most impacted and what communities were asking for around justice and around support.
So you've gotten your resolutions passed by the American Public Health Association, and their members are situated in a whole range of institutions all throughout society. What's the next step?
I hope that some of the next steps that we foresee is really lining up some of the research that we've done with what community organizing organizations are doing now, like with campaigns that are happening right now. For instance, Stop Urban Shield last year, I believe, or this year, we're able to get one of the local cities, I believe Berkeley, to not do the Urban Shield campaign in that district. And so the research that we did supported them in making a case with the local board of supervisors. So we want to use our research really to further support grassroots organizing. We also want to, you know, galvanize really the larger field of public health to really become involved in this work, including advocating for the solutions we've outlined, such as greater investment in racial equity and community-led responses to harms. I think that we have, by default, let law enforcement officers be first responders to health crises, including mental health crises, drug overdose, medical emergencies. And we think that those crises could be more appropriately handled by medical professionals. And so what we want to also look at when we're looking at community-led interventions is how do we make those investments in the medical community or in the health community to support individuals and communities who may be in crisis.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.